1981 it was when George Lucas and Steven Spielberg introduced the world to the greatest archaeologist adventurer in cinema, a character who had a very specific look and energy and some very helpful music from John Williams to paint a picture of him. Yes, the inimitable Indiana Jones made his big screen debut in the summer of 1981 in the Oscar-winning Raiders of the Lost Ark, a film that not only cemented Harrison Ford's status as a bona fide movie star, but forever changed the landscape of blockbuster cinema. A series of successful sequels followed, the latest of which is currently shooting in London, but the magic of seeing Indy on screen for the first time has never quite been equaled, I think it's safe to say. But how did Indiana Jones come about? What makes him so special? And just how difficult a time did Lucas and Spielberg have making Raiders of the Lost Ark? Some of the questions that Chris Wasser is going to answer for me this evening. But we start out with the fact that he nearly wasn't Indiana Jones at all, Chris.
He originally, Sean, was Indiana Smith, which is a fine name, but I don't think it has the same ring to it.
No, John Williams would never have come up with music like that for Indiana Smith.
No, I worry that Indiana Smith might have had something like a folk soundtrack, but that was the name that George Lucas put down in his notebook. That's where it all began, when he wanted to make a series of films. He's always kind of, you know, running before he can walk. He's always thinking of a franchise before a single film, but he had this idea in his head to build this trilogy of films that would sort of be a throwback to the type of pictures that he grew up watching in the 1930s and 1940s. He basically wanted to create his own, you know, contemporary matinee idol. You know, he was thinking along the lines of Buck Rogers and Zorro, and he wanted to even combine, you know, some character traits of Don Winslow, James Bond, and to create a new action hero and put him in a 1930s setting. The only problem was, while he was developing this character and while he was imagining what sort of adventures he would get up to on, or what sort of adventures Indiana Smith would get up to, he was also distracted by a little space opera that he was creating. So he was working on Flash Gordon first, couldn't get the rights there, so he thought, I'll make my own. Started up Star Wars, and Indiana Smith had to go on the shelf. But even then, I mean, this is in 1973 that he started thinking about it. We wouldn't get an Indiana Jones film until 1981, but as the years went on, he actually talked, this is George Lucas, he talked to other filmmakers like Peter Kaufman, who gave us the Right Stuff and the remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. He met with Spielberg and a few of the screenwriters. He was always talking about it, always developing the character. But what's interesting is that he never actually had a screenplay, even when he first sat down with Spielberg and they talked about it. They actually talked about it for the first time while George Lucas was taking a holiday in Hawaii.
Because Spielberg and Lucas at this stage, Lucas, as you said, had Star Wars, and Spielberg had Close Encounters of the Third Kind by this point in time as well. They were great buddies. How did Lucas then bring it from the point of, here's just another idea that I have? Because he was a great man for ideas. There were several of them flying around his head at any time.
That's right, and he still is a great man for ideas, but he always needs someone to rein him in. You know, as we saw from the Star Wars prequel, sometimes he can fly a bit too close to the sun. But himself and Spielberg were good friends. When Spielberg was making Close Encounters, George Lucas was making Star Wars. And it's hard to believe now that both men thought they were basically sitting on flops, and they actually took a bet on whose film would make more money, and whoever's film made more money, they had to give the other person a percentage of the profits. So let's just say, Sean, both men ended up very rich in that situation. But they were actually sitting, they went on this trip to Hawaii the month that Star Wars opened. They started talking about, you know, George Lucas started talking about his idea for Indiana Smith, and Spielberg was a little bit hesitant because he thought, look, it kind of sounds, George, like you want to make a Disneyland ride, you don't want to make a movie. But at the same time, Spielberg was interested in moving away from sci-fi, moving away from action horror. He wanted to make a James Bond film. So that's why Lucas said, look, I've got this character, I've got this idea, and they went to work. They took Peter Kaufman's ideas that I said, you know, George was meeting with years earlier. Spielberg hired this up-and-coming screenwriter, Lawrence Kasdan, who had impressed Spielberg with this romantic comedy called Continental Divide, and then of course he would go on to write The Empire Strikes Back. And they gave basically Lawrence Kasdan all of these ideas and said, put them together. Put them in a story for us, please.
And the story he gave us, or the beginnings of the story that he gave us, at any rate, is Raiders of the Lost Ark. In 40 seconds, give me the potted version of Raiders of the Lost Ark. What are we talking about?
We are talking about a film set in 1936. Harrison Ford is Indiana Jones. He is a handsome professor, academic by day, and a handsome adventurer by night. And when we first meet him, he has just lost the golden idol in Peru in a Peruvian temple to his archaeologist rival, Prey Belloc. And when he gets back to America, he finds some US intelligence agents sitting in his office, and they say to him, "Listen, Indiana, we have, you know, reason to believe that Adolf Hitler is after the Ark of the Covenant. And he believes that if he gets his hands on the Ark of the Covenant, he will be able to create this invincible army. And the only person we can think of who can find the Ark before Hitler is you. So we want you to go and get it."
And off he goes to Egypt, meets up with his friend Salah, played by John Rhys-Davies, who explains what is happening with the German search for the Ark of the Covenant in this clip.
"I knew the Germans would hire you, Salah. You're the best digger in Egypt.
My services are entirely inconsequential to them. You're hired or shanghaied every digger in Cairo. The excavation is enormous. They hire only strongbacks and they pay pennies for them. It is as if the pharaohs had returned."
"When did they find the map room?"
3 days ago. They have not one brain among them. Except one. He's very clever. He's a French archaeologist."
"What's his name?"
"Well, they call him Baloche."
"Belloc. Belloc.
The Germans have a great advantage over us. They are near to discovering the Well of Souls."
"Well, they're not going to find it without this. Who can tell us about these markings?"
"Perhaps a man I know can help us."
"Indeed. There is something that troubles me."
"What is it?"
"The Ark. If it is there, Atanis, then it is something that man was not meant to disturb. Death has always surrounded it. It is not of this earth."
We are in spooky land. Salah, played by John Rhys-Davies there, in a clip from Raiders of the Lost Ark, turns 40. It'll be 40 years ago this summer it was in cinemas for the first time, and Chris Wasser is helping us celebrate that 40th anniversary this evening. So we have a great idea from George Lucas, good screenplay from Lawrence Kasdan, a not bad director, has to be admitted, in Steven Spielberg, some pretty amazing music from John Williams. Could there be an Indiana Jones without Harrison Ford?
There almost was, Sean. I think when it came to the casting of Indiana, let's remember that he is this regular guy who also happens to be a brilliant professor and a brilliant architect, you know, and a brilliant archaeologist and a brilliant adventurer. But he's still, you know, there's an everyman quality about him. So George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, they wanted someone who could, you know, portray that on screen. They didn't want a movie star. They didn't want someone with this huge reputation behind them. And they actually started to make contact with Tom Selleck, and Selleck was cast. I mean, the job was his, and he had screen tested with Karen Allen, and he was all ready to go. The only problem was that he had actually shot the pilot for a little show called Magnum PI, and his contract stated that he had to remain available if Magnum PI was picked up. And Lucas and Spielberg actually went to the studio behind Magnum PI, and they said, "Can you release this guy from the contract, because we really want him?" But that only went sideways for them, because the studio CBS then realized, "Oh, Tom Selleck's in demand. Let's give Magnum PI a full series." So Tom Selleck lost out there. So it was Harrison Ford was actually maybe the third or fourth choice. They looked at Jeff Bridges too. It was Harrison Ford's work on The Empire Strikes Back, which had already filmed at this stage. Spielberg had seen the dailies and he thought, "Here's our man. He has some great dramatic qualities about him. You know, he's very good with romance too. He's quite good. He has this thing about him that he's a terrific actor, but he's always about a second away, it seems, from winking at the camera. And that's what we need from Indiana Jones."
That's exactly what's needed from Indiana Jones. And Indiana Jones with a big black moustache, I'm not quite so sure about that one, Tom. Although he's a fine actor, it would have to be said. So we have the goodies. Although Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones, he kind of has that kind of charming roguishness about him, which is helpful to the character. We need a baddie in here, and Baloche, as Salah would call him, or Belloc, as Indiana would call him, that's where we get one of our many baddies in this film.
Yeah, I mean, Indy is constantly coming up, and you see this in the sequels as well, across a string of baddies who basically always want this thing in a temple that will help them to create armies, or that will make them invincible, that will make them live forever. And Indy always has this thing about him that Ford is very good at, of just kind of going, oh, I suppose I'll go in and I'll save the day here. So it's never really been about the baddies, and you've never really... The weird thing about these films, despite the fact that you are totally invested in them and you care about what happens to Indiana Jones, there's never really any danger you sense that, you know, or you never really feel as though Indiana Jones is in any danger. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that Indiana Jones, it's a live-action cartoon. Spielberg was never making this po-faced, you know, adventure film. He was never making an adventure film for the times that, you know, for 1981. He was making a film that could have been released in the 1930s. I mean, when you look at that original poster for Indiana Jones, he's got the bullwhip, he's got the satchel and the fedora, his shirt is open, revealing this beautifully tanned chest, and even the lettering above, you know, in bold red and yellow. You're being told straight away when you go into the cinema, don't worry about the baddies, don't worry, this fella's got it. And he always did. And I think that's what made the film so brilliant, that there was always this self-awareness that we are making a bit of a cartoon here, but we're going to make it very, very well.
Yeah, and I suppose the baddies are, there's a bit of a cartoonish quality to them. But Belloc, played by Paul Freeman, quite cleverly tries to identify with Indiana to get him on side in this scene.
You and I are very much alike. Archaeology is our religion. Yet we have both fallen from the pure faith. Our methods have not differed as much as you pretend. I am a shadowy reflection of you. It will take only a nudge to make you like me, to push you out of the light.
Now you're getting nasty.
You know it's true. How nice. Look at this. It's worthless. $10 from a vendor in the street. But I take it and bury it in the sand for 1,000 years, it becomes priceless. Like the ark. Men will kill for it. Men like you and me.
What about your boss, Der Fuhrer? I thought he was waiting to take possession.
All in good time. When I'm finished with it. Jones, do you realize what the ark is? It's a transmitter. It's a radio for speaking to God. And it's within my reach.
You want to talk to God? Let's go see him together. I've got nothing better to do.
Next time, Indiana Jones, it'll take more than children to save you.
Yes, a scene there from Raiders of the Lost Ark. Paul Freeman as Belloc and Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones being saved by a bundle of kids at the end of that, it would seem.
Karen Allen plays the character of Marion here, who had a lot of great ideas around how that character could be fleshed out and been given a bit more dimension than it actually gets in the film, but they were thrown away by Spielberg.
They were thrown away by Spielberg, which is an absolute shame. Karen Allen, when she signed on to play the part of Marion, who is an old acquaintance of Indiana, who, I mean, the story, the story is a bit dodgy, Sean, to be honest. We're led to believe in the film that Indiana studied under Marion's father when he was studying to be an archaeologist, and that there might have been a romantic encounter when she was underage. And it's this throwaway line where she says, I was just a child, but we don't actually get a sense of, did something happen? Did he run away from something happening? What did happen, basically? And Karen Allen, she actually devised this entire backstory for her character about her dad and maybe what happened between Marion and Indiana, but it was all thrown away because it seemed as though Spielberg was only interested, Lucas too, in Indiana and in Belloc and in just, you know, the adventure side of things. And I think it's a shame because they could have actually turned her into a proper character, and they could have addressed what still is 40 years later a part of the plot that doesn't really sit well with fans, to be honest.
How difficult was it to make, briefly on this one, Chris?
It was a bit tough, Sean. They were given just 70 days to work with, $20 million, mostly because Spielberg had a habit of always running over time and budget. They shot in Tunisia, Hawaii, France, England. The problems occurred when they got to Tunisia, where basically 150 cast and crew members, including Harrison, came down with a bad case of dysentery, which they got from drinking the local water and eating the local food. And for weeks, the shoot was just, it was a horrendous place to work. And you can actually see some scenes in this film where Harrison, he's not sweating, he's not, you know, like reeling from a fight that he just had with the enemy. He's a very well man. And what was weird about it was that Spielberg, he had actually ordered in cans of tinned food from England before the shoot. So he was one of the only people on set. He was standing behind the camera saying, I'm fine. Let's get, you know, yeah. I hope everyone's going to be okay, but let's keep going. So it was a bit tough. And it resulted in some, not to spoil the film for anybody, but it resulted in some continuity errors, which you can still spot to this day in the final act.
I'm glad to know that I have something in common with Steven Spielberg. I'm about to run over time on this item, but just one brief last question on it. Are any of the sequels any match to Raiders of the Lost Ark? And what about the new one?
They come pretty close, Sean. I think Last Crusade, I think bringing in Sean Connery at one stage to play his father, that was inspired casting. That was magical. The second film for me, it kind of, you know, tone-wise, it's a bit dodgy. The fourth one, I don't even want to mention it. But, you know, look, as a trilogy of films, I still enjoy watching these. Every Christmas, as I'm sure an awful lot of other households do, it's sort of a tradition at this stage. They are fine films, but yeah. I don't think anything ever comes close to the first one because there was a sense that everybody involved was doing something that hadn't been done before. And in actually trying to make a film that was a trope back to the 1930s and 1940s, Spielberg accidentally created a whole new genre of adventure films. And that's not something that happens a second or third time. So it's always the first for me.
And we'll see the sequel or the new one that
we will
in
next
July,
summer.
Next summer. All right. Chris Wasser talking to us about Raiders of the Lost Ark, released in cinemas 40 years ago this summer. Now, if you're looking for a pleasant day out in Dublin city centre, why not head to Dublin Castle and the Chester Beatty? Currently on view is Edo in coloured prints from Chester Beatty's own collection. And the exhibition covers the early days of the city we now know as Tokyo, when the shogun and the samurai held power. I'm delighted to be joined by the curator, Mary Redfern. Edo in colour from the Chester Beatty collection itself, Mary. How vast a collection is it? It seems to be endless.
It does feel endless, often working with it. We're always finding new things, even though they've been there many years. Altogether, we've got over 27,000 objects in the collection. Obviously, anyone who comes into the galleries will just see a tiny fraction of that. That's partly for conservation reasons and partly for space. But it's an amazing collection to work with. It really is.
And the majority of collected by the man himself, Chester Beatty.
Yeah, no, he had really wide collecting interests. So Japan, China, Southeast Asia, that's just the area I look after. And then obviously Europe, the Islamic world, all kinds of incredible things from incredible places. And that's what we can show in the museum.
Edo in colour. Just tell me a little bit more about what I'm saying. Edo is kind of a previous day, if you like, Tokyo. What exactly are we talking about? We're talking about a period in time, really, as much as a place, aren't we?
Yeah, the name is actually used for both. So we talk about the Edo period and we can talk about Edo the city. But the city we now know as Tokyo, that huge, amazing metropolis, was only called Tokyo from the latter part of the 19th century. Before that, it was known as Edo. And Edo itself is an incredible city. It's only really established in 1590, and 150 years later, it's the biggest city in the world. It's got a population of 1 million, it's huge, it's thriving, and it's just this busy, exciting, energetic metropolis.
So the period that we're talking about then, we're talking Edo at the height of its powers, and that Edo period, it refers to exactly that. Is there a specific point in history where we are?
So the Edo period, the start is a little bit depends on which date you take, but usually we say the start of the Edo period is around 1603, which is when the Tokugawa shoguns get sort of full political power. And it ends in 1868 when the Meiji Emperor is restored to power. So it's this period of sort of 260 years. The prints themselves cover more like 1700 to the mid-19th century. But what we see is just this, it's a time of peace and it's a time of prosperity. And that peace is brought about because the shoguns have so much control. Before that, the country's really at war. But they bring this peace, they bring this order, they bring this stability. And within that, this amazing popular culture flourishes.
And part of that popular culture, and it's amazing how much these two aspects of popular culture are represented in the exhibition, I think. Two things, theatre and wrestling. One is as important almost as the other, I think.
Yes, no, I mean, the theatre is this, again, incredible place. And Edo, the Kabuki Theatre is the particular one that we focus on in the exhibition because that's the one that the prints really draw out the most. And Kabuki starts off in Kyoto, comes up to Edo, and just finds a new style in Edo. And it's this sort of warrior style. Everyone is a sort of superhuman, superhero. Everything is over the top. Everything is very flamboyant. And you get these superstars who are paid like Ichikawa Danjiro's salary, Ichikawa Danjiro II, his salary was something like more than $1 million. And he was a star, you know, he would swagger out on the stage. He had all his fans there wearing his headscarf, buying his merchandise, clamoring after him. And so the publishers aren't silly. So they're like, okay, we'll cash in on this and we'll start producing actor prints. And then sumo comes in and you get, again, sort of sumo becomes a feature. But then the other area that's really strongly represented is the prostitution districts, the brothel district in Edo, which is called the Yoshiwara, where you get these beautiful women in incredible dresses. But again, print is promoting it. It's promoting their celebrity and it's acting very commercially, but always with incredible artistry.
Yeah, so the prostitutes had a reputation, I suppose, is what you're saying here. And so there were specific women who would have been considered very valuable and had great monetary power.
Yeah, I mean, their actual power was always circumscribed because they were basically working under contracts of indentured servitude to the brothels. They were often sold by their families.
Somebody else was making the money.
Someone else had made the money already. They were often held in debt. But they were shown as being incredibly cultivated, incredibly refined individuals. And that was part of the sort of the mystique that the brothel district really cultivated, because it had a lot of competition in the city with unlicensed areas. So it sort of showed itself as this place not just about sex, not just about sex work, but also about really high culture.
And that's what the type of prints then that we see in this exhibition, particularly of that red light district, to use that term, we do see very sophisticated characters shown to us.
Yeah, so we've got a book by artist Suzuki Haranobu, who's one of the most important early print artists. And he's shown sort of a whole book full of different women from the prostitution district. And each of them is shown doing some kind of activity, flower arranging, playing cards, composing poetry, painting. There's nothing erotic about it. It's all very much these refined, sort of cultivated pursuits, because that's what they're selling it on. And each one is also has a poem with them as well.
And who would be buying these prints in the day? You know, because you're saying that both the wrestlers, the theatre stars, and the women in the red light district, that these had real value, these prints and these merchandises.
I think the most important thing to know is, obviously, if we see prints for sale today, you know, you see the Great Wave go on sale in an auction, they can achieve thousands, even sometimes millions, for something really special. But at the time, they were really affordable. So we don't have great data on the cost of prints, but we know that an actor print at some point might have been about the same price as a trip to the public baths. And later on, the price of a colour print was capped at the same price as a bowl of noodles. So in terms of the affordability, they're really affordable, but that never diminishes that the art is really sophisticated. And this is partly because it's such a competitive world. So you've got publishers, artists, all kind of fighting for market share and producing really sophisticated visual art throughout.
Well, in the section selling the city, rather, you get a real sense of the markets there. You can almost smell the fish that we're looking at on the page. It really is this hustle and bustle. That's what we're seeing in the prints.
Yeah, no, for me, that's what these prints are really about. It's the energy. There's just this sheer energy in the city. And the prints themselves, obviously, they're commercial products, so they're being designed to be sold. So they offer this really affirmative vision, and this kind of community comes through you. You get a lot of figures looking towards you, sort of inviting you into this amazing dynamic world that they're part of.
But we also, I'm just opening here and looking at one which really struck me when I saw it in the catalogue, which you kindly brought in. It's the colours in it. This is leisurely activities by the waterside. Nobody too stressed out in this particular place. Outdoor activity to go with our current summer. But it's the vividness of, particularly in this print, the green of the trees and the reds of the various and the colours of the various outfits that the characters are wearing.
You've actually caught me out there, because that's the one object in the exhibition which is not a print. This is actually a hand scroll painting that we have in the collection.
That's why it is looking so differently.
But it's important to know. So we talk about ukiyo-e, the pictures of the floating world, and it's a word people might have heard, but we when people hear it, if they know it, they'll always think of Prince. But actually, these pictures of the floating world include paintings. Many of the artists, Hokusai, others, would have done paintings as well as prints. And it's just about different areas of the market. Yeah. If you've got the money, you buy a painting. If you don't, you can buy a lovely print.
Pretty much like today, I suppose, yeah. In some ways. But so lest we give the impression that it's only in the couple of paintings that are there that we see those vivid colours, I'm now looking at a newly published perspective view of the Shinmei Shrine. And this has, again, a beautiful, vivid kind of salmony pink colour in it.
Yeah, no, there are some incredible colours in those prints. Sort of working with the designers on the exhibition, one of the challenges was sort of like, which colours do we focus on? What do we pull out of here? But the colours also shift as you go through. So the earliest prints are monochromatic, just black ink lines. And then they start to add hand-applied colour first, but that's obviously expensive. So they do printed colour, salmon pinks, greens. And then it's the 1760s when we get this kind of explosion of full colour printing. And it's sort of the best way I can liken it is sort of Dorothy stepping into Oz. You go from sepia into this blazing world of colour. And it's amazing.
It's the beginning of the 19th century, the 1830s, and basically as we're heading towards the end of the Edo period in some ways, this is when the Prussian blue comes into play. And I think people will recognise that colour. It's, again, a very vivid blue that you see in the prints.
No, and it's an incredible blue, and it's incredible for the printmakers because the blues, they'd had blues before. There's Dayflower blue, there's indigo. But both of those have limitations. Dayflower is quite vulnerable to light and other damage. Indigo isn't great for doing fine printing, but Prussian blue, this synthetic pigment, lets you print these beautiful gradations of colour, lets you print those swathes of blue sky, the swathes of sea. And that's the colour that Hokusai really just uses to its full in landscape
prints.
Hokusai
was one of the big... There's another character that's in there, one of the big artists of the time, is Hiroshige. Is that how I say that name?
Yeah,
and they were the big... Were they considered big stars? As big a star, as the wrestlers or the theatre artists?
Yeah, I mean, Hokusai definitely. He was working in paintings and in prints. Hiroshige also... But even for Hiroshige, like his earliest sort of big selling series, the 53 Stations of the Tokaido, when they produced that, he was still slightly unproven in the market. So they got a more famous artist, Kunisada, to kind of do a spin-off of it, just sort of help promote him a bit. So you get all this stuff happening. But yeah, the artists had big names themselves. Utamaro is the other really sort of famous one who cultivated this incredible artistic persona.
How important an aspect is Mount Fuji? Because Mount Fuji is in several of the prints, really. How important is that to the nature of the art that we see?
I think it's really critically important to Edo. And that's the main thing. So Edo, it's this new city. It doesn't have the history of Kyoto. It doesn't even have the history of Osaka. But it's finding history in its landscape. And it just happens to be about 100 kilometers from this mountain Fuji. And Fuji has had this incredible history in Japan. If you've seen it in person, it's amazing. If you've flown over it, it's even better. But it has this perfect conical shape, and it's the tallest mountain in Japan. And given Japan's Shinto religion, it has sort of huge spiritual significance also.
One final question. Now, people can see this exhibition online if they can't make it into the Chester Beattie itself, but it will be changed. You're not just asking us to stick with this for the entire season. It'll be changed in August.
Yeah, well, we have too many lovely prints and I couldn't choose. So I decided to test my colleagues' patience, and halfway through the exhibition, we're actually going to change all the prints on the walls. So we're going to tie it into the seasons as well. So at the moment, it's summer, and then come September, we'll be moving into our winter and spring prints.
So it's kind of a double exhibition in many ways. That's Mary Redfern, curator there of Edo in Colour, prints from Japan's metropolis. It's at the Chester Beattie through until December with that change of season in August. Chesterbeattie.ie will give you full details there. Thanks very much for coming in this evening, Mary. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening. With me this evening, Alan Corr and Andrea Cleary, who will cast their critical ear over the pick of this week's releases. Shortly, we'll consider Where I Should End from Saint Sister on the show with me earlier in the week. We'll also be talking about the latest release from Picture This. That's called Life in Colour. But we'll start with Town's Dead, the new album from Kojaq. That's Kojaque. 26-year-old Dublin rapper and MC, filmmaker and artist, also known as Kevin Smith. Let's start with the title track. He's talking about a Dublin that, if you listen closely to, I think you might just recognise. Yeah.
There we go. Title track from Kojak's new album, Town's Dead. Andrea Cleary and Alan Carr talking to us about our three albums this evening. I could have also said when I was listing out Kojak's achievements to date, Alan, I could have said album founder, because he has his own album. Is it on his own label that this album is released?
This is indeed on his own label and collective. It's called Soft Boy Records. This is the follow-up to Delhi Daydreams, which was his debut mixtape, which came out in 2018. The only release of its kind to be nominated for Choice Music Prize. And from there, he really took off. He toured with the likes of Slowthai, the English MC, also toured with Lana Del Rey. But I suppose you could call this a concept album. And what it reminded me of, it was the flip side, I suppose, of For Those I Love, which was the great debut album that came out earlier this year. And, you know, that was an album that kind of dwelt on kind of sadness and lamenting the loss of a great friend. But I think this album is a far more darker journey into Nighttown, and indeed this young rapper Kevin Smith's own psyche. So if the For Those I Love album was a hug, this is more of a headbutt, Sean.
Yeah, there's a feeling of that certainly in it. And his target here is fairly clear, particularly in the song we just listened to, Andrea, Town's Dead, where we get lyric like, now the corpos are knocking down the flats just to build a few gaffs, just to fill them with some triple barrel surnames. He's aiming at a certain sector of society there.
He's aiming straight between the eyes, yeah. And he's always been brilliant at astutely representing a broken system. I think with great humour, with great turns of phrase, like the one you read out there. And here, where the housing crisis in particular looms very large over this story, he's just particularly brilliant. Every issue, every relationship on the album, every element of the story is told through this lens of class, the changing face of Dublin. Simple things like not being able to find somewhere to go on New Year's Eve to have a party, which is what the concept sort of is loosely kind of based around here. And there's also a kind of a love triangle in there. No matter what it is, he never forgets the politics of the thing.
Yeah, Andrea mentioning it there, the couple of interludes along the way, Alan, that give us this kind of journey on New Year's Eve, a bundle of guys basically looking for a party.
It's very funny. It reminds you of those kind of old school skits and interludes you used to find in hip hop records back in the 90s. But it did remind me somewhat of kind of original pirate material by Mike Skinner and the Streets, the great album from the early noughties, for this, that kind of sprawling, multi-layered, multi-storied kind of concept album. And the fact that it's bracketed and kind of interrupted by those kind of funny little skits is fantastic.
But just I want to play No Hands, which I should warn, like many of the tracks on the album, we had a radio edit of Town's Dead, but most of the tracks you'd have to give a quite strong language warning with them. But there's sadness in No Hands here as well, Alan.
Oh, very much so. I mean, this is a very reflective song about his childhood, set in 1998, and it really brings it into the heart of his family and the situation they went through after following the death of his father by suicide when Smith was just a child. It's very, very touching indeed, and it shows another side to this guy.
Colder days, I'm dreaming about the olden days. Slouching in my lounger, but my mama had me sitting straight. Cause I'm doing it no hands.
Little section there from No Hands from Kojak's album Town's Dead. Andrea, as we're listening to that, just remarking on his dexterity, the flow that he has in the way that he raps.
He's an incredibly talented artist, and I think you can kind of get so swept up in the story of this that you forget that he really is one of Ireland's most talented lyricists. There's so much character and narrative and experimentation in this record. It's a real firm statement of intent, not only in what he's trying to say, but how he's saying it. He's coming out and he's saying, I can actually do this. I'm a fast rapper at times, I'm a dexterous rapper. I'm able to convey anger, I'm able to convey sadness, I'm able to convey poignancy. And he does all of that so well at the turn of a dime.
And in a very authentic voice too, Andrea.
Incredibly so, yeah. Yeah, you believe every word that comes out of his mouth. Even when you have these more kind of character-based, sketch-based things, like he does break the fourth wall, as it were, on the tracks where he's kind of talking about his family and kind of talking about his father. But even when it's the more character-based stuff, you still fully believe that where he is. And you can see Dublin. You can see empty Dublin, as we all have seen over the past year and a half. You can visualize it while you're listening to the textures on this record.
I'll just mention one other thing before I ask you both for stars. There's a great jazzy kind of sexy jazz club, smoky jazz club feel to certain tracks.
He can do the silky hip hop very well.
He certainly can.
Yeah, Curtains is a very funny ending to the album, which is like that lounge Liverman kind of vibe.
Yeah, he has all of that. Right, stars from you first of all, Alan.
Well, I think this guy is a saint in the city and words are his blessing, Sean. This is nocturnal, frenetic, visceral, as you say here in Dublin, dirty. I'd give it 4 out of 5.
Dirty, 4 out of 5. What are you saying, Andrea?
I think it's funny, it's moving, it's ambitious, and I think it's a really important cultural artifact of the current political time. It's an excellent album. I'm giving it 4 stars out of 5.
4 stars out of 5. So I'm a chord on that particular album. Let's move on to Saint Sister. We're in with us on the programme on Tuesday night. I played a track from the album last night, Where I Should End, and if you were listening on either of those nights, you'll kind of know where I stand on this particular album, but it's the reviewers' opinions that we're looking for this evening. Saint Sister, our songwriter, I'm very positive about it, I should clarify for those who didn't hear. Saint Sister, songwriter Morgana McIntyre and harpist and producer Gemma Doherty met as music students at Trinity in 2014. Definite departure for you here, Andrea, I think, in terms of how they have moved on from their debut album, Shape of Silence.
Yeah, I think they started out with a really solid bass with Shape of Silence, which was in 2018 nominated alongside Kojak's Delhi Daydreams, actually, for the Choice Prize. So it's interesting that we have them both back together this year. And while that was a beautiful album, it was definitely a bit headier. It's really nice actually to hear them leaning a bit more into pop melodies, and they sound a lot more comfortable, kind of having fun with their sound. There's a few really genuine, honest to God pop songs on this record. I was delighted to hear them.
Well, let's hear how the album opens. It's a track called My Brilliant Friend. Opening track there, the opening of the opening track, My Brilliant Friend from the Saint Sister album, Where I Should End. You enjoyed the organ at the beginning of that, Alan. I thought you were going to go down on your knees and start
Well, it's
praying.
The only thing I would miss about Mass is the organ, Sean. I think that song is rather beautiful. It's a great opening to what is a very calming and soothing album with a spiritual and a political nature running through it. So I think it's a track that really stands there for me. I'm not sure if you're going to play it. It's the place that I work, which sounds to me...
Played it last night, actually.
Yeah, which
this
sounds
is the one
to
with
me
Lisa Hannigan,
It could have been written by Sally Rooney. It's got this kind of normal people kind of quality about it.
Well, you do know that they were in Trinity the year behind Sally Rooney.
Well, you see, I didn't know that.
And they told me on Tuesday night that all of those characters were very like them in Sally Rooney's
well,
novels.
There you go. This is the kind of audio book or the musical version then, because it certainly has populated by those kind of people, I think, you know.
Mind you, we'd all love a friend in some ways, like the brilliant friend that she's singing about in that song, I think, Andrea.
It's a beautiful song, and they've such a, and I think actually also on the place where I work as well, there's a few songs here that are just such good stories. They're really leaning into their kind of like folk storytelling side of things here, and it really, really suits them. I think they've done an excellent job with the lyrics in this album and really evoking a sense of place and a sense of relationship and story, because it does kind of follow a relationship that is falling apart.
Yeah, and that's
over the course of the record, and you kind of say that and you think it's one thing, but by the time you get to the end, you're kind of emotionally exhausted, aren't you? Like it takes a toll.
It's not just the lyrics; it's the musical journey that you're brought on. And I know I've said the word journey, and some people get in an awful bad mood about that word. I think it's a useful word at times, but you are brought on quite a trip with this.
I thought Journey were a great band. Well, I mean, this is music that mixes the organic with the electronic, I suppose, and it's got the beauty of those hushed vocals, those kind of halting vocals, and those kind of off kilter experimental arrangements. I mean, there's not enough of the harp in there, considering that
harp's beautiful in places,
the harp is great, but I would like to have heard more of Gemma Doherty's harp in the mix here. I think the most successful song in it for me is the last song, Any Dreams, which reminded me of Philip Glass's Kyanis-Sketchy, and hopefully that points the way forward for these guys.
She also told me about her love of Philip Glass and Steve Reich in the interview.
Well, there
Tuesday
you go.
Nights.
That's very apparent here, I think.
You listened. You're telling.
I always listen, Sean.
Yeah. Let's listen to a little bit of that final song, Any Dreams. There we go. Opening section there of the final track on the Saint Sister album. The track is called Any Dreams and the album is called Where I Should End. Andrea, that has a touch of the poppy aspect that you were talking about, I think, in there, although the mention of the opening lyrics are kind of really stop you in your track. And I presume it's the Crash Ensemble who are performing on that track. They're across the album. They're collaborators across the album.
Yeah, as far as I know, it is, and there is definitely the touch of pop there. There's maybe a little bit of a gentle LCD sound system there. Elsewhere, I mean, a song like "Oh My God, Oh Canada," that to me is a really beautiful kind of gentle folk rock song, really, and it's really great to hear them use percussion and lean into a bit more of a traditional kind of band sound. I think it actually really suits them. And then, you know, we haven't mentioned Karaoke Song, which to me it just sounds like an ABBA deep cut. And I say that as the greatest compliment that I can give anybody who's writing pop music. I think it's so witty and charming, like deeply charming and really confident. And they're just writing these hooks that are so wonderful. Yeah.
And really poppy, as you say, in the opening sections, I think in particular, maybe tracks 3, 4, 5 in around that middle part.
Yeah.
Stars from you, Andrea.
Yeah, look, I think it's their best work so far. It's confident, polished and transcendent, really. If you'll allow me, I'm going to add a half a star onto what was originally my my review, and I'm going to give it 4.5 stars.
4.5 from you. Alan, what are you saying?
3.5.
3.5 from Alan. Let's move on then to our final album this evening, 4-piece from Athy, County Kildare. No, they are Picture This. Back with the third album called Life in Colour. And among other things, they're giving out about parties, house parties, but in Los Angeles, believe it or not.
I went to a party in LA where all of the girls were too pretty for me. And everyone talking had nothing to say, 'cause these people are weird.
Now, are you a vodka and ice drinker, Alan Carr, that Picture This are giving out about?
No.
That's a really great poppy hook that we're getting there.
Absolutely. I think this album is a vast improvement on their last album, Modern Love, which I did not like at all. They seem to have rediscovered their souls on this album. I think they kind of needed to calm down on their last record, which came out a couple of years ago. And they've kind of gone back to basics in some ways. And these guys have had an incredible rise since they formed Nathalie about 5 years ago, selling out the Three Arena in 2.5 seconds and stuff like that. This is very, very good, expansive pop rock. It's very glossy. It's very slickly produced. My problem with this band has always been Ryan Hennessy's voice and his lyrics. He sounds like your man from the Coronas, and his lyrics are kind of gauche without being endearing. But this is the nature of pop, and you'd have to be a churl not to admit this is a very fine pop album.
And not only that, I'd say the album is pretty critic-proof, as was their Meteoric Rise. Andrea, would you agree that that's a fair assessment of how they've got to where they are so quickly?
It's certainly how they got to where they are. Yes, absolutely. They're a social media band, really. They went to number one in the Irish charts with their first album. They sold out the Olympia Theatre before that was even released, if I remember correctly, and famously went on to sell out 5 straight nights in the Three Arena. I actually went to one of those nights. I think it was the third night.
When you say they're a social media band, you mean the difficulty there, I suppose, is if you're doing something on social media and you're finding something, you click on it, you don't like it, you click off very quickly, you don't click back on. So they really have to get people with the first listen, don't they?
I think so. I mean, you can click on and that click still counts for them. So, but I think that, they're definitely, I think, still going on the relationships that they've formed with their fans in those early days. I suspect that those fans are going to grow out of this band. And to me, this album does absolutely nothing to invite new listeners in. I disagree entirely that it is a good pop record. To me, it's this kind of boardroom pop, meaning that they're really sticking to a playbook of what's worked well in the past for other global stars like the likes of One Direction and Ed Sheeran. But,
yeah,
you know, they're singing about things like isolation and disillusionment with fake LA parties, and these, like, the thing that really gets my goat is the one-dimensional love interest songs like Winona Ryder, which is essentially this girl isn't like other girls in song form, and they're just singing these lyrics that are vague enough to apply to any one of those hundreds of thousands right. of girls.
Well, let's have a little 30 seconds of Things Are Different, which clearly you don't think they are at all, Andrea.
Not at all, no.
Some of us will drift apart while others stay together. Don't know how much longer.
Sorry, gonna have to go. Have things changed? And I can't remember if you gave stars to their first album, but sounds as if you didn't like it, or to the previous album. What are you giving to this one, Alan?
Well, these guys make Maroon 5 sound like a band of revolutionary anarchists. I think that Ryan Hennessy thinks he's a rock star in his own head, and that's good enough. I mean, I'd give this 2 out of 5.
Out of 5. What are you saying, Andrea?
I think it's pop music entirely devoid of heart, and young music fans deserve to spend their precious time and money on bands that offer a lot more than this. It's 1 star from me.
That's a very clear review from both of you there for Life in Colour from Picture This. And before that, Andrea Cleary and Alan Carr speaking to us about Where I Should End from Saint Sister, and Tan's Dead from Coach.